Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
I'm Kimberly Atkins, and this is On Point. More than half of American adults have now received at least one dose of a COVID vaccine, and nearly a third have been fully vaccinated. As of this week, all Americans 16 and older are eligible for the vaccine. But plenty of questions remain. What's happening with the pause in administering the Johnson & Johnson vaccine? What are we learning about the effectiveness of the vaccine against COVID variants? And crucially, when will enough people be vaccinated for something like life as we knew it to return? This hour, On Point, we're answering your questions about COVID-19 vaccines. To help us with that, we're joined by Saad Omer. He's director of the Yale Institute for Global Health and professor of infectious diseases at the Yale School of Medicine. Professor Omer, welcome to On Point.
My pleasure.
And we're also joined by Rupali LeMay. She's a behavioral scientist at the Johns Hopkins University Bloomberg School of Public Health, studying vaccine hesitancy and public health messaging. Rupali, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So as I mentioned earlier, 50% of American adults have received at least one dose of vaccines. But that, of course, means that there are varying levels of vaccination and immunity right now, sometimes within households and families. I know I got the Johnson & Johnson a day before my fiance got the first dose of the Pfizer. So we're at varying levels of vaccination. One on-point listener, Ashley, asked us about what that means for families.
I would love to hear more on the risk assessment with grandparents that are fully vaccinated, parents that are in the process of being vaccinated, and obviously the children are not vaccinated. So how to handle that situation and what type of risk if the grandparents are indoors with the kids?
Professor Omer, let's start with you. What do you say about that?
So it's a little bit nuanced, but I think there are guidelines that, that people can use. So it depends on the risk of children and grandchildren. If they are assuming they are low, themselves are low risk, the current guidelines and the current evidence, not everything has a guideline at this point. So later in the program, I'd be happy to talk about what the evidence directly suggests. I think it's pretty safe for grandparents to interact with a small group of children and grandchildren, so one family of children and grandchildren, even indoors and without mask, provided that the children and grandchildren are low risk. That's what's in line with the CDC guidelines. There's more nuance to that. It's a lot more safer to interact, even with mask or without mask, but especially without mask outdoors. And so we know that, a family gathering indoors has a different risk fact baseline risk profile than a barbecue, outdoors, et cetera, on the patio and so on and so forth. So keeping in mind this incremental approach to reducing risk, I think at this point we do know that if grandparents themselves are vaccinated, they can interact indoors, even without masks, in a group where some are partially vaccinated and other are unvaccinated, provided those who are partially or unvaccinated have a low risk profile.
Rupali, should we be worried about this J&J pause, or does that show that the system is working?
I think the first point is that it does show that the system is working and that safety is being taken very seriously. I think with the J&J pause, essentially six individuals reported dealing with a rare blood clotting disorder out of almost 7 million doses that were given. So when you think about that risk, that's about 1 in 1 million. And the reason that there has been an investigation, and I believe ACIP is meeting again, I think this Friday, to have a better sense of can we continue to look at the data and update recommendations if needed, is simply to see if there is a link between these rare blood clotting disorders and the vaccine. And right now, we don't know that. And so to me, it's an indication that we have the correct safety monitoring systems in place, that the safety of the vaccine is taken very seriously, and to really reassure the public that this process through the EUA, the regulatory approval, has all been done very thoroughly and systematically.
And how do we do that? I mean, we're going to talk a little later in the show about, for some, that pause in the J&J vaccine really did cause some hesitancy. How do we message? I've spoken about my experience, but what more can be done in terms of messaging to really tamp down that hesitancy?
I think the key thing from my perspective is always thinking about how can we build trust with the individuals that we're asking people to engage in the behavior, in this case, getting a vaccine. I think an issue that we've seen throughout this pandemic is that there has been, again, a perceived lack of transparency. People feel as though state health departments, the CDC, the FDA, the administration has not been maybe transparent with not only recommendations related to non-pharmaceutical interventions, but also the way in which the vaccine was developed and the way it was tested. And so I think the key here that underlies everything, in my opinion, is really how do we ensure that the communication that we are providing is coming from a trustworthy source. One way to do that is to ensure that there is transparency. I think the great example is the J&J pause, is that we had individuals from ACIP get together. That was a public meeting. Individuals could tune in if they wanted to hear the deliberations. So I think more of that transparency, also though at the state level, is going to be critical if we do want to continue to see a reduction in hesitancy, because we do know that moving forward, so far we've been vaccinating individuals that aren't hesitant. They're essentially individuals that could be ambivalent and that are pro-vaccine. However, as we continue to get more doses, and we've now vaccinated more than, I think, 30% is fully, more than 30% of the population is fully vaccinated, as we continue to increase those numbers, it's going to be harder and harder to essentially reach that last group of individuals.
Okay. Professor Omer, we got a call from listener Antoinette Piet from Virginia asking us about how the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines might affect existing conditions.
I am a sufferer of severe arthritis. There was a time when I was treated with a product called Harboni, and it exacerbated my arthritis 10 times. I'm really worried that this is going to happen with this particular antiviral vaccine. I would love somebody to address what happens to the people that are already suffering from arthritis.
Professor Omer?
Yeah, that's a good question. We don't have any evidence of exacerbation of existing conditions like that. We continue to study vaccine safety, but so far things look good in that direction. And so even for theoretical concerns, we're not fairly high for these kinds of things. But when you look at clinical data, it's further reassuring.
We have a question from a listener on Twitter at Shady Neutron says, since the Pfizer shot needs a booster every 6 months and I need to wear a mask even after getting my shots, how will I know when I'm, quote, immune? Acknowledges that that's a trick question, by the way. But I'd love to hear what both of you have to say about this idea that we will need to mask even after we're vaccinated. That can be confusing to people. Professor Omer, what do you tell our listeners?
So first of all, I will clarify, there is no current guidance in the U.S. that suggests that we will have to get vaccinated every 3 to 6 months. I think that information is coming from, that perception is coming from studies that looked at, that followed up people after vaccination for various periods of time. And since our trials happened in late fall, we have now 6 months of data, and it showed that it was pretty decent immune response through 6 months at least. So that's not a ceiling, that's a floor. Another part of confusion is coming from some of the press discussion and statement from the Pfizer CEO, who said that people would need or may need a vaccine booster shot every year. I wish he had tempered his language in line with the current evidence. Right now, there's no policy at the U.S. It's not a done deal. What we are looking at is booster options. So, which is the appropriate thing to do? To doing research now, so that in a few months, if we require an additional booster, we are ready with the lab and clinical data to support that decision if needed. And frankly, from what we know from other coronavirus vaccines, it's less of a concern that the immunity itself will wane in a year's time. It may wane over a few years because a vaccine that starts with a 95% protection against all symptomatic disease, I'm talking about the two mRNA vaccines for now, doesn't vanish in a year altogether. The one of the reason as a booster is being considered as a policy option, again, the emphasis is an option, is because of the uncertainty around the variants that are emerging throughout the world. So the host may be protected, but the pathogen may evolve. And even for that, it's not certain that we will need a booster shot. And so keeping that in mind, in that context, so that's the good news, that we, you know, it's not a done deal that we would need a booster shot, but even it's not the end of the world if we need a booster shot every year, frankly. But you know, just to share the state of evidence, I think, and I am of the perspective that the public health community and CDC should have a further step-by-step approach, and it has largely had that step-by-step approach of easing up on recommended restrictions. And just to set the context why we have these masking recommendations, even for vaccinated people in a lot of situations, we know that these vaccines are highly protective for the people who take the vaccine. When the trials were done, we did not have endpoints that looked at the transmission of this virus from the people who are vaccinated. But and now
Professor Omer, I'm going to pause you right there. We're going to come back to this after we take a break. We're answering your questions about COVID vaccines. I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins. Today, we're answering your questions about COVID vaccines. We're joined by Professor Saad Omer, director of the Yale Institute of Public Health, and by Rupali LeMay, a behavioral scientist at Johns Hopkins University, at the Johns Hopkins University Bloomberg School of Public Health, studying vaccine hesitancy and public health messaging. Professor Omer, you were making a really important point about masking, and I want you to complete that point.
Yeah, so I was talking about when these trials were done. We did not have direct evidence whether there is protection against infection, so people's ability to give this virus to others, et cetera, or acquire it. We had the trials were designed to see if people themselves were protected by, you know, from this virus, from especially symptomatic disease caused by this virus. Since then, we have had increasing evidence. It's not rock solid, but it's pretty convincing evidence to suggest that these vaccines, especially the ones being used in the U.S., are reducing transmission of this virus as well. So that's super important. Because a lot of the reason why we were asking people to wear masks is because we wanted to make sure that, you know, they don't transmit the virus to the others. But there is a nuance there. People need to remember that the data suggests that the protection against transmission is lower than the protection against disease. So even if you have lower transmission, lower likelihood of transmission if you're vaccinated, it's not zero and it's lower than your own level of protection. So now keeping that in mind, we will have to be considerate of others as the rates of infection are high. These masking recommendations will be a little bit more stringent. But as the rates of this infection goes down in the community, you know, vaccines work as an individual intervention, but also as a community intervention. So as the weather warms up, people go outside a little bit more, and there is increasing vaccination, then, you know, to answer your listener's question, there will be more flexibility. Even now, several of us scientists believe that there is more flexibility outdoors than indoors, especially if there's nobody around.
Okay. So I want to pause there for a moment because I want to spend a few minutes focusing on vaccine access and vaccine hesitancy. So joining us from Cleveland, Mississippi is Pam Chatman. She's founder of Boss Lady Workforce Transportation. Pam, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So briefly tell our listeners what Boss Lady Workforce Transportation, what the work that you are doing during the pandemic to increase access to vaccines.
So what we're doing here, we created an organization that's called BTI, which is Vaccination Transportation Initiative, and we're helping those Mississippians that do not have transportation or can't afford to pay for transportation to get to the nearest clinic near them. So we're paying for all of that. And then we're also doing drive-through pop-up vaccination. We're partnering with different health organizations and hospitals and clinics across Mississippi Delta to make sure that everyone has an opportunity to be vaccinated.
So, Pam, tell us what made you realize the need for VTI was there? What made you realize you had to do this?
Well, we live in rural Mississippi Delta, and so most clinics are 25, 35, and as far as 45 miles away. So people were having a difficult time, and then we started to see the numbers, the data nationally that say that people, African American, were not being vaccinated and that the access to getting to those particular clinics were hard. Was a hardship to them. And so that's when we decided that we needed to do something to help those individuals that wanted to be vaccinated to get to those local clinics.
So you have been doing this for a while now. Do you find that the biggest barrier for the Mississippians that you are helping to be just that access to a vaccination site? Or do you find that hesitancy is a problem too? Do you have to also work to convince people to get the vaccine?
Absolutely. Hesitant is a large issue here in Mississippi Delta. You hear many different things. You hear, I don't trust the governor, the government, and you hear that I don't want to be a guinea pig to be tested. We hear that this is not real. We hear so many different things. And so just like the speaker said a few minutes ago, it's about how do you get these individuals in Mississippi to trust you? And so what I did was I decided to go ahead and get the Moderna so that they see me, a former news director for 25 years. If they trust me, then they would decide in their mind, if she did it, I can do it too. So a trust factor is a big, huge issue here in a poverty-stricken Delta.
So I want to continue this conversation about hesitancy and bring in from Nashville, Tennessee, Blake Farmer. He's a senior healthcare reporter for Nashville Public Radio. Blake, it's great to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me, Kim.
So we were listening to Pam talking about the hesitancy that she encountered with folks in the Mississippi Delta, a lot of different people down there, poorer folks, black folks. You are talking about hesitancy in your reporting, but in a different segment of the population. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, you know, a lot of the southern states, I mean, so you're talking where Pam and I are, Tennessee, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, are seeing a lot of the same thing. I mean, vaccination rates are really lagging. And I think the thing that is surprising to public health officials is that it turns out that white rural conservatives, particularly evangelical Christians, are essentially the least likely group to get the vaccine, which was very much unexpected.
Right. I mean, at the beginning of the vaccine, I know that I reported on and a lot of other people reported on vaccine hesitancy in the black community, in the Latinx community. There would be a lot of uncertainty, a lot of distrust there. Why do you think we're seeing it now among these white, largely male conservative folks?
Well, You can come up with some reasons, and a lot of it does feel political. I mean, there's several surveys that sort of show that folks who voted for President Trump are less likely to get the vaccine. And certainly, if you look at a map of these states, Mississippi or Tennessee, you could see that, like, wow, the voting map, you know, is a pretty good match for sort of where the hesitancy is. But when you are out actually talking to folks, asking, well, why aren't you getting the vaccine? You know, rarely do politics come up. You know, there may be some very specific anecdote or something that was read on Facebook or, you know, just kind of this blanket, you know, it was done too fast, kind of a real easy sort of an answer. So, you know, I just got off the phone talking with a pediatrician who works in a rural part of Tennessee who, you know, is even having difficulty getting her own staff to get vaccinated. It's just it's a complicated thing. And it similarly, though, to some of the expectation of the hesitancy in the black community, the Latinx community, it is this sort of trust issue about, you know, trusting what the government is essentially asking us to do.
So, Pam, tell us a little more. Can you tell us a case of someone who you came across who was hesitant and that you had to dispel myths and somehow convince them? You said you yourself got the Moderna shot to make that task easier. Can you talk about a situation where someone's mind had to be changed, Pam?
Yes, absolutely. We were getting ready to do a drive-through vaccination in our community, and we were all signed up to do J&J. So we had about 350 people that were ready to go to get vaccinated. And that particular morning when J&J was halted, literally you saw people, once it was announced to the crowd, everybody start to pull out. And so we had about 50 cars that were still there in the line. And so we began to start talking with them. The health people that were there, the nurses that were there, started to talk with them. Many of them had illness, pacemakers. And so we just had to convince them, you know, take a chance to get the vaccinated. And so most of them decided that they would go ahead and do it. But we have a lot of people here that have a lot of illness. And it's so important when you talk about trust. You know, it's organizations like the Community Foundation of Northwest Mississippi that are partnering with me. It's different health agencies that are partnering with me that, you know, it's about people that they know every day that are taking a chance and they're getting vaccinated. That is what a lot of people need to see and hear. Not all the negativeness about, you know, the blood clots and this happened to sick people, this happened to that. We need to get these people vaccinated so that we can get back to some type of normalcy in the world again.
And Blake, what was the impact that you saw with that news of the pause in the J&J vaccine?
Well, you know, I even think of my own interaction with folks when I'm talking about people when they're you know, talking about their hesitancy, and they might sort of give me some misinformation, like, well, you know, it's the vaccine has killed several people. And yeah. I will, before the J&J thing, I would say, well, you know, I think you may be using the information there. But, you know, now if you want to find a reason to be scared of the vaccine, you don't have to look all that far, even if the numbers are sort of a one in a million kind of a situation. So, the folks I've talked to who are sort of leaders in rural communities trying to get folks vaccinated, they are very concerned that this Johnson & Johnson news, while it in one way shows that the safety mechanisms are working because you have these blood clots in one in a million folks and you're pressing pause, you know, for folks who are just getting a little bit of information and then making their decision based on that, it is going to be very difficult to overcome. At least that's the fear.
And Blake, are there any, how are local officials helping to try to dispel this hesitancy? Are there organizations or folks like Pam there in Tennessee, local officials really pushing to try to convince these folks that the vaccine is safe and that this isn't a political or governmental plot or any other myth?
Well, there is certainly a lot of folks leading that push. You know, I'm here in Nashville and you know, all the city's leaders are really pushing. We've got a goal to get 50% of folks vaccinated before the month of May. But for instance, you look statewide in Tennessee. Not all governors have been this way, but at least Tennessee's governor has been fairly muted on the point of vaccination. Not that he has a problem with vaccines. I mean, each year he gets his flu shot and makes a pretty big media deal of it, puts out a picture of the health commissioner giving him the shot. But on the COVID vaccine, frankly, reporters kind of had to pull it out of him that he had been vaccinated, just not being out front on this issue, which I think just goes to show that this is fairly sensitive in some political circles, that getting vaccinated is something folks don't want to talk about. Frankly, I've talked to several white evangelical ministers who are like, I'm just sort of letting my congregants decide for themselves, not wanting to push anybody. Whereas, you know, you've seen in, let's say, black churches where there's almost an expectation that black ministers are going to be leaders on this issue and even hold maybe mm-hmm. vaccination clinics in their churches. So there is certainly leadership on this point, but it's not in every community.
Hey, Kimberly, can I add to
yes.
that?
Absolutely.
And he's so absolutely right. It's been those community organizations. It's been the churches. You know, at our church, St. Paul, here in Cleveland, Mississippi, it's been us out there since the pandemic doing everything from getting COVID testing to getting the vaccination. So it's been the community, not the politician. It's been community organization, people like he and I that have been out there trying to encourage, trying to educate, trying to empower people to get vaccinated. It's community organizations like Community Foundation of Northwest Mississippi that are out there that want to help organizations get the word out to the people.
And Pam, what do you need from community leaders, from elected officials? What do you need to continue to do what you do to help people get vaccinated?
You know, what we need right here, right now, is that we need more community leaders to step up to the front and be transparent. We need more people across the country. We have recently been getting a lot of donations from all around the world to help us to continue to pull those people out of these rural areas and take them to get vaccinated. And we're doing that through Community Foundation of Northwest Mississippi. People have sent donations from, I mean, all around the world. We recently got a donation for $20,000. That's just how serious that some people that do not live in Mississippi, that are from Mississippi, really want the people to take action And that's why we're calling this a national call for action. We need community leaders to continue to step up. We need more ministers to continue to step up and educate your communities, educate people in your church that they have to get vaccinated.
And Blake, the last word goes to you in about the minute we have left. Do you see local leaders and other local folks galvanizing in the same way in the Nashville area?
I mean, definitely in the Nashville area. But there's even a bit of desperation because even in more urban areas where there's been more demand for the vaccine, demand is really kind of softening. And I'll give you one example. The convention center started offering walk-up vaccinations yesterday, and there were not nearly so many people coming to get the vaccine as they had vaccines to give, even without appointments. So there is some concern that there's going to need to be an even bigger push to get folks to get vaccinated and to get to a level that really will protect and provide some of this herd immunity that we're pushing for so hard.
Absolutely.
All right, well, Blake Farmer is a senior healthcare reporter for Nashville Public Radio. Blake, thank you so much for taking time today.
Thanks for having me.
And Pam Chapman is the founder of Boss Lady Workforce Transportation. Pam, it was so great having you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
We're talking about vaccine hesitancy in the U.S. and answering your questions about all things vaccines. I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmanning, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins. Today, we're answering your questions about the COVID vaccines. We're joined by Professor Saad Omer, director of the Yale Institute for Global Health, and by Rupali LeMay, a behavioral scientist at the Johns Hopkins University Bloomberg School of Public Health, studying vaccine hesitancy and public health messaging. Now, last Wednesday, Dr. Scott Gottlieb, the former head of the Food and Drug Administration, shared his concern about the demand for vaccines running out on NPR's Morning Edition.
I think we get to 150 million vaccines. I think we struggle to get to 160 million. Beyond that, I think it's going to be difficult. I'm not sure that you have the demand there.
So, Professor Omer, we heard from Blake in Nashville and also Pam in Mississippi, both saying that at times the demand was waning in those places. How concerned are you about that?
Very. So just to highlight that we are in a situation where there is a group that remains hesitant. The group that was in the wait and see mode is shrinking, but it's not nearly small enough for us to reach herd immunity. On the other hand, people who want the vaccine want it more passionately than a normal flu vaccine, for example. So therefore, for a while, that obscured the public perception, or that created the public perception that there is no hesitancy to this vaccine. Those of us who study this in more detail, we're seeing that even in early priority groups, that there was always a chunk of people, not a majority. Vaccination is an increasing social norm in this country, just to highlight that. But there was always a chunk of people in each of these groups that was hesitant for this vaccine. But now, since we have opened up, we don't have the next group to go to maintain sort of that high demand per se overall. So I am very concerned, and hopefully we'll come back to some of the interventions this country can do to address that.
So this is from a listener on Facebook, Patrick Farrell. He says, the messaging for getting a vaccine is also not well thought out. I have had both of mine, and I'm not an anti-vaxxer by any means. But when those on the fence are told, even after vaccination, you still have to wear a mask, social distance, and live the same as you have the past year, many of these folks will not get it. Their thinking is that if nothing changes, then why do it? Rapali, what would you say to both folks who are on the fence who have that belief, and also to leaders and health professionals? What can they say to those folks to convince them that getting vaccinated is still necessary?
It's a great question. And part of the issue is that we're in a dynamic situation. I mean, one thing from a scientific perspective is that recommendations are updated as we gather more data, and we're able to provide recommendations with regards to the types of behaviors we would like individuals to engage in. I think we are hearing this. I think the messaging is really tricky because we want to make sure not only do people get the vaccine, but then to your caller's point, we still want people to wear masks. We still want people to social distance. And that has to do not only with risk of transmission, as Dr. Omer mentioned earlier, but it also has to do with the fact that we're not close to reaching herd immunity. I think part of the issue is that we need to continue to think about ways in which that we are being transparent with the messaging. We're trying to nudge demand towards vaccine acceptance. And I think we have to think about the types of appeals that we're using. What I mean by that is what's really driving people from an attitudinal perspective as to whether or not they would accept a vaccine. For many people, it's thinking about a societal benefit, i.e. you get the vaccine so you can hug your grandchild, for example. That might be an appeal that will work. For others, it might be that we can get back to work, right? So there's these different appeals that a number of us have been testing and have been looking at to try to determine, is there more of a universal appeal that we can use? And then how do we tailor some of these appeals and approaches to really focus on those that are hesitant, because there are issues related to trust? And I think the two earlier speakers from Tennessee really also, you know, focused on this point, this idea of how do we build trust. And part of it to me from a messaging perspective is perhaps moving the messaging away from public health authorities as the source authority, i.e. the messenger, and moving to more community influencers, whether that be pastors, whether that be other individuals that are community leaders that are not necessarily linked to health, because they may be more trusted right now than individuals that are sort of seen, I would say, in the healthcare system and domain.
Professor Omer, what do we know about variants? I mean, the first reporting about variants, there was a concern that they would have higher transmissibility or higher infection rates. Has that borne out? What do we know, and how does that affect where we are in terms of the vaccinations and where we move forward?
Yeah, so there are several variants out there. The ones that we are more intensively focusing on are the so-called variants of concern, meaning that they have shown initial characteristics that should raise some concern to keep an eye on them, etc. So there are three of those that we are very sort of more concerned about, or we are focusing more intensively on. The first one is the so-called B.1.1.7 variant that was initially identified in the UK. We know it's here, and it's in significant proportions in our communities. And so therefore, we need to be aware of that variant. The bad news is that it transmits more effectively than the run-of-the-mill, the so-called wild-type virus. Then the good news is that the current vaccines we have seem to work very well against this variant. So that's the reassuring part. There are a couple of other variants, the one that was initially identified in South Africa, the B1351 variant, and the P1 variant that was initially identified in Brazil. That's where the data are a little bit mixed, but it does seem that our vaccines do work against those variants as well, specifically against severe disease like hospitalization and death. So while it is reassuring, it is a little bit concerning that there are variants out there in the world that are not really prevalent here at this point that we need to be concerned about. The point to emphasize there is as Americans, we should realize that we are not 100% safe unless everyone in the world is safe. So if we do not advocate for global vaccine equity and distribution, we will remain vulnerable as a people. Yes, there are huge advantages in this country to have high immunization coverage, but if we want to be 100% sure and we want to go back to the full normal or a near full normal, we will have to make sure that the rest of the world gets vaccinated as well so that these variants do not emerge and the newer ones do not emerge in the near future.
And that relates to a question from our listener, Adam Barrows, who has a question about traveling.
Now that more and more people are being vaccinated across the United States, what will the shift be for travel?
Professor Omer, you were talking about the fact that the world needs to work together. It's not just about the country. What will travel look like in the future?
I think as we get vaccinated, travel, at least domestically, will open up and should open up. So as someone who studies these kinds of things and sort of drawing upon the sentiment one of your earlier callers had, that we need to make sure that we clearly communicate what is different after you get vaccinated as a motivator for vaccination or even otherwise. Like, you follow evidence-based recommendations. If the evidence suggests that you need to be more cautious, so be it. If the evidence suggests that you can do more activities, that's part of evidence-based communication. And so right now, as more and more people get vaccinated, it will become more and more safe to domestically travel. Right now, the situation is that CDC classifies domestic travel as a sort of a low-risk activity if you are vaccinated. Mm-hmm. But it also means that we have a lot of virus in the community. So the balance for folks could strike is that, for example, if you were going to don't go for optional stuff, but go for, you know, family gatherings or small groups where, you know, grandparents are traveling to meet grandchildren, etc., and other smaller groups domestically. Internationally, that's a little bit more nuanced. I think we'll have to do case-by-case basis. And one smart thing that happened, and I'm really surprised that it didn't happen earlier, is that the State Department travel recommendations were aligned with the CDC travel recommendations. So pay attention to that, because that's not just for our protection individually, that's for risk of importation of other variants as well. So international, case by case, and the reason why. So for example, those of us who work on sort of epidemiology of this virus and on this virus and these studies, you know, even those of us who do that haven't traveled in this period. But I am thinking of some of being able to travel for some high priority studies and being outside the U.S. to do that, because that has good risk benefit equation while complying with all the CDC recommendations. Domestically, things will ease up and should ease up as we get more and more vaccination into people's arms.
I want to get to as many listener questions as possible. One from Twitter from Carlett says, what is the recommendation for people who have recovered from COVID-19? Should they receive the vaccine? And how soon after recovery should a vaccine be administered? Professor Omer?
Yeah, that's a very good question. They should receive the vaccine because it does provide additional benefit. There is some scientific work going on about the number of doses, but individuals should not worry about it. When that work gets to a level where it warrants policy change, it will be communicated. Right now, but we do know, that's certain, that they should receive the vaccine. They do have an option of they shouldn't receive it while they're in isolation, obviously. So after the isolation is over, based on the usual criteria that you have, if you have an active disease and you are in isolation, once that is over, while they need to receive this vaccine, they can afford to wait for up to approximately 90 days to start their schedule. So that is the window that your infection provides you, because we know that there is some protection, a reasonable level of protection after natural infection for approximately 90 days. But so that's the flexibility that you have, but you should get vaccinated.
And Rapali, you know, what about the idea we were talking about travel just now? We're also seeing some restrictions be eased in a lot of communities. What do you think about the idea of vaccine passports or vaccine passes? Might that be something that encourages people who might not have been vaccinated yet to get one so that they may do more of the things that they did in the before times?
I think it's a challenging question, and I think it's a challenging approach. You know, I think you speak with individuals that are adamantly opposed to these types of passports because they feel as though it really infringes on their rights. You know, on the flip side of that, I think a number of us that work in countries not in the U.S. are required to show that we have been immunized against certain pathogens, and that's simply to protect importation and spread of vaccine-preventable disease. And so I think part of it is really going to have to be, what are the ways in which we are comfortable as we start to quote unquote moving back towards a normal day-to-day existence? What are we comfortable with regards to risk? Is that essentially we want to take people's word and really focus on what I think a lot of governors are doing, for example, with mask mandates and saying that we're going to personally appeal for individuals to continue to engage in these behaviors? Do we take people at their word and say that they have been vaccinated? Or do we essentially ask for some sort of documentation? And if we do start to ask for some sort of documentation, that then leads to issues, as you can imagine, with regards to fakes popping up on the internet. You know, I've already read some stories that have looked at this with regards to individuals, right, fabricating their vaccine immunization cards. And so I think it's a real challenging question. And I think you're going to have people, especially with regards to, you know, touting the argument of civil liberties being trampled on. And I'm sure bioethicists have been also exploring this at large. And so unfortunately, it's not an easy answer. It's more of a complicated and nuanced, I think, answer to that question.
Professor Omer, right now, vaccines are available to everyone over the age of 16. But what about kids? Do kids need to get vaccinated too? And how effective is the current rollout with just focusing on adults?
Eventually. So we will need kids to be vaccinated against this virus for several reasons. First of all, while the risk is higher in older age groups, it's still high compared to the baseline in kids, etc. It's not as high, but it is still a risk posed to their own health. So there are syndromes that are restricted to children. MIS-C is one of those syndromes, that is the multi-system syndrome that we are very concerned about. That is, a reaction to the virus. So once the virus invades children's bodies, after a few days, this huge immune response in response to the virus, not the vaccine, the virus is launched. And so therefore, there's a severe syndrome that we are concerned about for children. But the second reason for that is, for focusing on childhood vaccination, is that they count in the denominator for so-called herd immunity. So they count for indirect protection. And if you were to have sustainable opening of schools, sustainable return to normalcy, we'll have to include children. The update is that right now we have vaccines for 16 and older. There's a Pfizer vaccine that has already been evaluated from 12 to 15-year-old. And slowly there are trials being conducted for children, focusing on decreasing age groups, et cetera. And eventually all children will hopefully be covered by this trial data. Once that happens, we expect an emergency use authorization amendment for each of these products, and eventually children will be eligible.
All right. Saad Omer is the director of the Yale Institute for Global Health. He's also associate dean of global health research and professor of infectious diseases at the Yale School of Medicine. Thank you so much, for Professor Omer.
My pleasure.
And Rapali LeMay is a behavioral scientist at the Johns Hopkins University Bloomberg School of Public Health. She's also the director of behavioral implementation of science at the International Vaccine Access Center. Thank you for joining us, Rapali.
Thank you so much.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast on our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.